It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kend. Many Americans are sleep deprived. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, roughly 1 in 3 people don't get enough Z's. And once we are able to drift off, what is happening in sleep cycles, especially REM, rapid eye movement, and twitching? Call in with a question or comment as we discuss the science of sleep, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Blumberg is a professor and the chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good morning. You've been studying sleep now for decades. What attracted you to the science of sleep?
Actually, it was just a course that I took in graduate school at the University of Chicago with one of the pioneers of sleep research, a guy by the name of Alan Rechtschaffen. And although it took me a decade or more to finally get into studying sleep, that sort of planted the seed that was sitting there. And I eventually, you know, made my way through it. I made it through by studying development. And I was studying other aspects of development in baby rats, temperature regulation and vocalizations and maternal behavior and things like that. And then I started to notice certain things about sleep in baby rats, and that hooked me and eventually sort of moved my entire research program in the direction of sleep.
In this vast research area of sleep, are there still breathtaking developments? Is there still a lot to be learned?
Oh, there's more to be learned than not. I mean, we're still in the, I would say, in the baby era of understanding sleep. I mean, it really took off the sleep field in the 1950s, 60s or so. That's when things happened. It's even accelerated in the last 20 years in an enormous way. But we still have a long way to go in terms of understanding basic issues about sleep.
Wow. And your research focuses on what's called REM sleep. Give us a primer here. What is REM sleep?
Well, sleep generally in mammals and birds, let's focus on them for now, they fall into two categories of sleep, two broad categories. One is called REM, or rapid eye movement sleep. It's got a number of other names. It's called active sleep. It's been called inappropriately dream sleep. It's called a paradoxical sleep. So it's basically an aspect of sleep that is, it's characterized by a lot of activity. That's one reason why it was called paradoxical sleep, because you're asleep on the one hand, but you're doing a lot of stuff on the other. And that stuff includes, you know, an activated brain that looks more wake-like than sleep-like. And also there are a lot of movements, the rapid eye movements that gave it its name, the twitches that occur, irregular breathing. There's just a lot going on. The second form of sleep is called non-REM. Sorry.
I was going to say, that doesn't sound very restful.
It is. Well, rest is a, you know, we often think of rest as doing nothing, but but there are things that have to go on while we're sleeping, as it turns out, that are important for just being able to do what we need to do.
You also said REM sleep, inappropriately called dream sleep. Why is that?
Well, because we dream in all aspects of sleep. The dreams can be somewhat different in quality, but and I'm no dream expert. That's not been the focus of my work. But we have dreams throughout the night in both stages, both primary stages of sleep. It's just that the dreams that occur in REM sleep are the real bizarre ones, as it turns out. So it's they're more of the hallucinatory types of dreams that people think of, I think. Lots of strange things happening in them.
Why might that be?
We don't know. One of the dominant theories is that the activity that's happening mostly in the brainstem, massive amounts of activity that's sending information up to the brain, to the cortex, and the cortex is sitting there receiving all of this seemingly random information or random activity, and is trying to make sense of it. And so it could have something to do with just the heightened activity of sleep and the cerebral cortex's, I'll say, its desire, in quotes, to try to make sense of it, that gives those sorts of dreams their hallucinatory quality.
We're talking about the science of sleep with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg as our guide, and you can join in with your questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So Mark, REM, part of a cycle. What other kinds of sleep are there?
Well, there's the other part that's appropriately called non-REM, also has a variety of other names. It's called quiet sleep. It's called synchronized sleep and delta sleep. It's got a, you know, one of the problems with the field is we have a lot of names for the same things, reflecting somewhat our ignorance about what's going on. But the non-REM form of sleep is where we're mostly relatively still. Our breathing is very regular. There are these dominant waves of activity in the cortex and other parts of the brain that are called, that are the slow oscillations of brain activity. So not that jumble of activity that we see during REM sleep. And so it's a very, very different set of factors, of components that are going on in that stage of sleep.
Is there evidence that one type of sleep is more important than others in the cycle?
Yeah, no, I don't think we should go there. I think it's, I think that there are people, there are sleep researchers who prefer to study one stage of sleep over another. But I think they're both extremely important. They're both highly conserved across species. They seem to be more complementary than antagonistic. So probably it has something to do with one of them doing something that the other one picks up on and completes or restarts or cycles back on. So it's, like I said, one of the biggest mysteries, one of many mysteries about sleep, is how REM and non-REM sleep complement each other across the sleep cycle.
As you then view the barrage of sleep cycle terminology, what distinguishes REM sleep from deep REM sleep?
Well, the word deep is used often in a lot of confusing ways. It's sometimes used for the non-REM part of sleep to indicate that it's harder to wake somebody up from that phase of sleep. But so it's not a word I use a lot because I've always found it to be very confusing when applied to sleep like this.
Okay.
So I mean, I think, you know, REM sleep, it's very hard to wake up from, except for the fact that that's the stage of sleep that we normally wake up from in the morning, assuming we don't have an alarm clock. So when you're waking up in the morning, you're waking up typically out of REM sleep. So that's one aspect of it. But while you're in REM sleep, it can be very hard to wake you up. In fact, sometimes dreams will work their magic to sort of cover up things that are going on in the outside world. Like an alarm clock may go off, but you will incorporate that alarm clock into your dream, thus protecting your sleep, at least for a few more minutes.
Looking to infants now, infants spending about 16 hours a day sleeping, as much as half of that time is REM sleep. Why do babies need to sleep so much?
Well, that's the motivating mystery of my adult life, I guess, is trying to understand that. So, you know, 99% of research in sleep is focused on adult sleep. And yet the dominant, you know, states in newborns is sleep. I mean, we sleep more when we're young than in any other time of our lives. And so that's, to me, a real reason to focus on sleep in early infancy, because it's just happening so much. And so if you want to understand how sleep functions and how it comes together and how the parts work together, I think studying how it emerges over development is a really good way to go. And so that's why I've focused a lot of my research there, because it's proven to be, you know, a goldmine of information in terms of understanding basic things about sleep. So it's just a weird quirk, you know, of how science can sometimes go, where people focus on the things that where things are happening actually less often. But the mystery really is that, yes, we are sleeping 16 hours a day as babies, newborns. It's even more than that in utero. So it could be up to upwards of 80%, somewhere between 70 and 90% of the time we're asleep in the womb. And that's typical across all mammals, birds, and even many other types of animals. So it appears to be a universal feature that we sleep most when we're young. And many years ago, in the 1960s, it was suggested that that connection between sleeping a lot when you're young the idea was that you sleep a lot when you're young. So what does that tell you? And what else is going on when we're young? Well, obviously, we're developing. Mm-hmm. We're growing. We're incorporating our body into our brain. We're figuring out how our body works. We're constantly adapting to our changing body. You know, as the limbs are growing and our weight is changing, we're getting taller. We're learning how to behave. We're learning in lots of things. And so it was suggested that maybe sleep plays a role in that developmental process. And so that's been something that I've been focusing a lot on, and as have a few other people on this problem.
Professor Mark Blumberg studies sleep and behavioral development at the University of Iowa. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists uncover different ways that the brain is activated during sleep, especially during the REM sleep stage with the rapid eye movements and the little twitches and jerks of the body. We explore the latest science on brain activity during sleep, and you can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg, who is a behavioral neuroscientist. Mark, REM sleep often associated with dreams. I know you don't study dreams per se, but are dreams a reason for REM sleep or simply a byproduct?
Well, that's been those are the two competing ideas that have existed for millennia, really. You know, it's very hard to answer that question because it's hard to gain direct access to what people are dreaming. But here's where I think things have gone, where the concept of dreams got in our way. So take the twitches that you've referred to that occurred during REM sleep. These are fine movements. They're very unique movements. And they have been, you know, classically or, you know, referred to as, you know, like a dog chasing its dreams or something like chasing rabbits or something like that. And that idea goes back to Aristotle. And so if you think about that, if you think about dreams as causing those movements, then you think, okay, well, what could explain it? Why are they just incomplete movements? Why are they twitches? And so the idea was that during REM sleep, you are functionally paralyzed. Your brain is actually inhibiting the movements of your limbs, except during these very brief periods when the twitches are allowed. And so what you might think is, okay, well, maybe you're dreaming about something very complex, but this paralysis system, this muscle atonia, as it's called, prevents you from acting out your dreams. And so what happens is that the twitches are just like these little shadows of those dreams sort of squeaking through, leaking through the system and showing themselves at these fine little jerks. So that's one way to think about it. It's a dream outward movement kind of an explanation. But there's another possibility, and the one that I think is actually correct, which is that instead of having, if you think about the dreams happening in the cortex, so everything's flowing down from the cortex through the brainstem, through the muscles, and that's what's producing the movements. But the reversal of that idea is this, that the brainstem, which we know is where the twitches are actually produced, is producing those movements for a purpose. Hmm. And then what's happening is that you're generating those movements, and you have sensory feedback coming from those movements, from the stretch receptors in your muscles. It can be from the touch, you know, the sensitive parts of your skin to touch, if you happen to touch an object. And so you get this feedback coming in, and now that's what's causing the flow of information up to the brain, and that is what's causing, sometimes shaping, the types of dreams that we have. So those are two very different ideas. And the thing is that we actually have strong proof-like evidence that the latter story is the correct one, that the brainstem produces the movements. The movements have sensory feedback consequences, which then flow into the brain. I've recorded this activity throughout the brain of baby animals. And you see just how light lit up the brain is in relationship to twitches, not from the cortex down. Moreover, at the ages that I'm studying the sleep in our animals, the cortex can't produce movements. It's actually not functionally capable of producing movements. It's true for human infants, probably through around four to 6 months after age, after birth. And so we know that the cortex couldn't even produce the dream-like twitches if it wanted to. And so that's, so it's this reversal of the causal relationship, which I think is fascinating from a conceptual perspective, mm-hmm. but also happens to be super important just from an understanding how the system works perspective. And so then the question might be, you know, well, what do twitches do? What makes them special?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And is there a more quantity of REM sleep in the infants and babies you study?
Yeah. So that's when it's happening the most. I mean, probably somewhere around 50% of the time is spent twitching in a newborn rat. We see similar things. We also, in my lab, we also study human infants. We study them after birth. We study them at full-term infants. We study premature infants in the neonatal intensive care unit at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. And so we see just an enormous amount of twitches, as we suspected we would based on what we know in other animals.
And, you have very, very young research subjects who can't mm-hmm. clearly communicate. Is that a challenge in your research?
No, it's a relief. it simplifies the problem, right? Because you're no longer, if you're studying dream activity, then you ask somebody after they wake up what they were dreaming about. And it's all very, it's hard to really have confidence sometimes in what you're being told. But it's for us, it challenges us when you can't rely on verbal reports. It challenges us to come up with really good, solid methods for figuring out what's going on inside the brain and the body during sleep.
We're talking about the science of sleep with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg. You can join in with your questions and comments. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Martha in Port Washington with a question. Hi, Martha.
Hi, good morning.
What would you like to bring up?
My father has a progressive supranuclear palsy, a fairly rare brain disease, and he sleeps now pretty much any time he's not being woken up for a meal or to go to the restroom. So I'm wondering what the purpose of sleep is in that, or the function of sleep is in that disease process.
Martha, thank you for that question. Mark, go ahead.
Well, I'm not an expert in that particular disorder. I'm not a clinician, I should say. But sometimes there are conditions in which sleep becomes the predominant state. And that could be looked at, I suppose, as sleep doing something functional, but it could also be due to a failure of the arousal system. So, you have these two competing systems where you have sleep pushing for its dominance against an arousal system that keeps us awake. And in a way, you can think about you could also think about that as what's happening in early development too, that we sleep a lot because the arousal system hasn't developed sufficiently. But I think as we get older and we start to have problems like these, certain types of diseases or disorders, you're going to have sometimes problems of the arousal system. So what really matters in terms of understanding what's going on in sleep is to have sleep tests, actually sleep measurements to know what kinds of sleep are happening. Is it normal sleep? Or is it, something else? So that's, and I'm sure that's happened in this case, but that's all I can say about this condition.
When you talk about the arousal system, Carol in Milwaukee wants to know what debilitating effect does being awakened four times a night have on a person?
Yeah, so there are a variety of sorts of problems that arise when you have disrupted sleep. And it shows itself in a variety of different ways. I think you at the top of this of the hour, you mentioned how many people in the United States are not getting enough sleep. Now, how much sleep you get is a very subjective thing. And anybody who tells you should get 7.5 hours or any number is just wrong. There is no definitive number that's true for any given individual. I mean, across, based upon averages, what really matters is whether or not you wake up in the morning feeling refreshed. I mean, that's ultimately, it's up to you to decide how much sleep you need. But the problem is that, we have all of these things that happen in our lives that prevent us from getting good sleep. Either we stay awake too long and can't fall asleep, or we wake up throughout the night. And that waking up throughout the night can happen for a variety of reasons. It could be because you have to go to the bathroom a lot. It could be because you have a deficit in the neural system that keeps you asleep. So there are just a whole host of things that happen. And as we age, one of the things that happens among many is that we have more and more troubles regulating our body temperature. And it turns out that REM sleep will not happen if you are too cold or too hot. Huh. And so if you're losing your ability to regulate your temperature and you don't have a comfortable environment to sleep in, like either you don't have, good heating system or cooling system, depending on the season, then you will not have the right amount of REM sleep. And so there's just a host of ways in which sleep can be disrupted, as we should expect from something as complex as this is.
It seems to be a very sensitive cycle that you're studying.
Yes, yeah. It is very sensitive. Yeah, very ancient, very well regulated. But, you know, there is some evidence that across the lifespan, there are a few, you know, there are parts of the brain that have relatively few neurons, on the order of thousands, not millions. And those neurons die across our lifetime. And when they get to a certain point, when too many have died, that's when you start to see problems like insomnia.
Professor Mark Blumberg studies sleep as chair of University of Iowa's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. You can join the conversation about sleep at any point. Call in with a question. Add your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Sleep happens in stages. We explore REM sleep. Eric in Roseville, Minnesota believes that sleep helps their aging father's body to recover and repair with the medicine he's taking. You can email with your question, your thoughts, ideas at WPR.org. Mark Blumberg here, professor and chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. Let's bring in Tom in Green Bay. Tom, hi.
I have a question regarding SSRIs and their role on the sleep cycle. About 7 years ago, I started taking Lexapro, which, you know, helped with my anxiety, but it messed up my sleep cycle to where I would have trouble falling asleep and would wake up every 90 minutes, which I'm assuming was at the end of my sleep cycle. I take mirtazapine to help me sleep. It's like a light sedative and another anxiolytic. And that helps me stay asleep throughout the night. So I know you're not a doctor, but I would like to, you know, get an idea of what serotonin's role is on the sleep cycle and why some sedatives may also positively or negatively impact that. So.
Tom, thanks for the question. Ooh. Mark, go ahead.
Yeah, it's a conundrum that faces anybody who takes drugs that affect these sorts of systems. So, you know, your listener's correct. SSRIs, they influence the serotonin system. There are other systems like serotonin. They're all called neuromodulators. Other examples are things like dopamine that many people know about, norepinephrine, which many people know about. And all of these, what's really interesting about these neuromodulatory systems is that they are all involved in sleep regulation. So if you record from the brain areas that produce these neuromodulators, you will see that they are variously affected by sleep or many times contributing to sleep. So, for example, the serotonin system is highly active during wake and they turn off during sleep. Same thing is true for the norepinephrine system. And so, and there are other ones that are the opposite, that are active during wake and during sleep and then turn off during wake. And so it should be no surprise then that when you take a drug that influences these systems, that there are going to be side effects that are going to influence your ability to sleep. That's the problem with pharmacology, you know, with taking drugs, is that you can't target things just for the problem that you're trying to address, because these systems are affecting lots and lots of different things: learning, memory, arousal, you know, attention, and so because of that, and physiology, and so because of that, you're going to have these sorts of problems. It's just until we have more targeted drugs, if such drugs will exist, that we're going to have these problems that creep over into the sleep-wake cycle.
Tom, thank you for that question. Kathleen now in Sun Prairie. Kathleen, hi, go ahead. Hi, Kathleen, can you hear us? Okay, Kathleen, I'm sorry, we can't hear you at the moment, but Kathleen is wondering, Mark, what about people whose sleep cycle is reversed, that you sleep during the day instead of during the night? What happens in the brain cycle?
Well, the sleep, you have a, you know, this, this reversal of the circadian phase is basically what is being referred to here. It happens in a small number of people. And you know, your sleep can be quite normal, such as it is in that reversal state. But what's failed is that you don't have a system that's regulated typically for your species. Now, of course, there are species that are nocturnal. Rats are nocturnal. They're awake at night, or more awake at night than during the day. And so, you know, we're a diurnal species. We also tend to sleep in huge chunks of periods, 8 hours typically. And that's not always the same for other animals either. But the key is that, you know, when you're the part of your system that regulates your circadian system, your 24-hour day-night cycle, it can develop abnormally, and you end up with the circadian phase problem. It's funny, the person who wrote an article about my work and others in the New Yorker in the end of August, she has a sleep circadian phase issue. So she's awake at night and she sleeps during the day. And she wrote a piece in the Modern Love series in the New York Times. It was actually made into one of their short little things about her trying to find love as a you know, with a person who has a normal sleep phase cycle. So it happens, and people learn how to adjust to it, but it can be very, very difficult given the way our society is set up.
In the presentations you make, you've referenced a circus performer, Johnny Eck, who starred in the 1932 movie Freaks, and his legs never developed and learned to walk on his hands. How does that story relate to your research with sleep?
Yeah, well, it's one of these weird things. So I wrote a book about it, called Freaks of Nature. It came out some years ago, and it was about all the different ways that development can happen. And Johnny Eck was a circus performer, and he was an actor, and he was in a movie called Freaks, directed by Todd Browning, which came out in 1932, which I highly recommend, a rather bizarre movie. But what Johnny Eck was special, but not special for people with his condition. So he had an issue called amelia, which is a failure of limbs to grow. In this case, it was his two legs. But people have similar problems with their arms. And it's not only true in humans, it happens in other animals. And I have a whole host of videos demonstrating that animals with these developmental anomalies do remarkably well if left to their own devices. So there was, you know, the medical profession would often try to intervene and try to create solutions, quote unquote, to their dilemmas, but they're best left to themselves. People without arms, they learn how to walk on their, without legs, they learn how to walk on their arms, and they're extremely agile and athletic, and they get along just fine. And people who are born without arms, they learn how to use their feet and legs in all kinds of ways that we cannot. They can type with their toes, they can... I have a video of a man who smokes with his toes and lights a Bic lighter with his other foot. I have a video of a dog without two hind legs who's running on a beach on his forepaws beautifully, just beautifully. If you wouldn't know there was anything wrong with his dog until you see that there are no legs there. So how does it all connect? This is a phenomenon known as developmental plasticity, which refers to the extreme amount of ability of a developing system to organize with the body it has, not necessarily with the body it was supposed to have. Supposed meaning from a perfect species specific sort of a perspective, which is clearly wrong. And so the question is, how do you develop your limbs in this atypical way? So if we were to say, like, well, how do I function, or how do you function with, you know, whatever, arms and legs, and you would say, well, it could be genetically hardwired. That's a very simple, facile kind of an explanation that you hear a lot about. You just say, oh, the genes do it, or it's just, it's an instinct, or all of these things that people say that drives me kind of bonkers. So the problem with any genetic hardwiring, of course, is you can't hardwire all of the things that you can't anticipate about development. You don't know how fast you're going to grow. You don't know what you're going to eat. You don't know what kinds of food you're going to have, and therefore how much muscle you're going to develop. And how much muscle you have is going to determine how you use your limbs. So you need to be plastic. You need to adapt in real time to the body that you have, whether it's just that, you know, arms that are getting overdeveloped or absence of limbs entirely. And so that's where I believe twitches come in, because twitches are ideally suited because of the way they're produced, how they're produced, and the influence that they have on the brain activity. They are in an ideal position to tell the brain and the entire nervous system what kinds of limbs you have, how many joints you have, how many muscles, how are they operating with each other, how are they producing the movements, and then actually using all of the activity that you see during twitching to produce the types of movements that allow your brain to compute all the possible things that your limbs can do. That's the challenge. That's the sensory motor challenge of development. And that's what I believe sleep. That's one of the reasons why I believe sleep is so prevalent when we're young.
Wow. We're exploring sleep science with University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg, neuroscientist, our guide. You can join in. Questions and comments, they're welcome. 800-642-1234. Jamie in Algoma is next. Jamie, hi. What would you like to ask?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am going to be working this Thursday, a morning shift. I'm usually evenings, and I had to do it yesterday to train, where I have to be at work at 7 in the morning. Now, working second shift, my body just sleeps until it naturally wakes up, which I love. But if I have to set an alarm, without fail, my body wakes up at 3 o'clock, and that's it. I'm awake. I feel like a shot of adrenaline hits and I do not go back to sleep. I can force myself to stay awake, but boy, is it really hard to force yourself to go to sleep. Any hints?
Any advice there on trying to stay with that rhythm and stay asleep, Mark?
Yeah, no, I face that problem. I think everybody has these, you know, the anxiety of waking up early and the use of the alarm clock. I mean, the problem with alarm clocks, and the reason why I'm really happy to have a job where I don't need to rely on them, is that alarm clocks are going to wake you up randomly with respect to what state you happen to be in when the alarm goes off. You know, now the ideal way to wake up is naturally out of a REM sleep episode, and you have more REM sleep in the morning than you do early in the evening when you go to sleep. So that's the challenge. I believe that smartwatches are getting to a place where they are timing. They can time the alarm to the stage of sleep. So if they work, and I haven't looked into the scientific validation of them, but if that's the sort of solution you want, an alarm clock that would time you to your sleep state, preferably to wake you up after a period of REM sleep.
My smartwatch has that feature. I haven't used it yet, but it is giving me that option when I do set an alarm. What effect can alcohol, other substances have on sleep?
Well, I mean, alcohol is a central nervous system depressant, and so it's going to blunt many of the things that happen during sleep that are important. On the other hand, alcohol relaxes people and can reduce stress, and so can help you to fall asleep. So you end up with this double whammy where it might help at the beginning of sleep, helping you to fall asleep, but can make the quality of your sleep lesser than it should be over the night. So, you know, pick your poison.
University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg with us studies sleep and behavioral development, and there's space to talk about our brain and sleep. Call in with a question, bring your discussion points, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We spend about one-third of our lives sleeping or attempting to drift off. We explore the REM sleep cycle, what could be occurring in the brain, and we discuss your questions. Call in with one, share what you wonder. The number is 800-642-1234. University of Iowa Professor Mark Blumberg is a behavioral neuroscientist researching the functions of sleep. Let's go to Quincy in Middleton now. Quincy, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Yes. What would you like to bring up?
So I have been blessed with a very healthy sleep life. And the last several years, I've been using an app called Sleep Cycle that it turns on periodically if I'm snoring or if I'm speaking in my sleep. The next morning, it's always interesting to hear what I've had to say. And one thing that I have noticed is that I can go 3 or 4 months without remembering a dream or without sleep talking. And then I'll have like a week or two of just really active sleep life where I'm talking up a storm and I remember multiple dreams in an evening. I'm wondering if Mark has any theories on why that comes in cycles like that.
Quincy, thank you. Mark.
Well, I think you've discovered something very interesting. I mean, I think one thing that's going to happen, I mean, thank you for that question. I mean, I this is one of the things you asked earlier in the program about, you know, how much do we know relative to what we don't. And I think this is an example. I mean, maybe there are scientists who've studied this sort of aspect. I've never seen in all the conferences and other things I've gone to hear about sleep. I've never heard about these sorts of things coming in bursts like this before. I think that's one of the advantages happening with all these wearable devices and all of these apps that are out there is that we're going to start to get maybe new insights into phenomena that we didn't know about as to what causes these sorts of bursts of unique activity during sleep. I mean, what your caller describes, it sounds fascinating to me. I just don't know of any research that's looked at it that in that way. But I think that's going to be one of the benefits. I mean, one of the challenges in the past has been, you know, to do sleep research, you'd have to bring people into your lab and they'd have to sleep in a very artificial environment in the lab. And maybe you'd get them for 1 or 2 nights and maybe you'd get them, I don't know, on a random basis, a month, every year, whatever, but not the kind of daily, sampling that your caller is describing, where you can actually see these, because it could be extremely random or could be, you know, very idiosyncratic to the individual as to how these cycles are organized. So, I think it's fantastic. I think we're going to learn so many interesting things.
Yes, the technology that's available to consumers could very much have scientific implications. And on that front, Mark, how do you envision doctors or scientists might be able to take what you've learned in your research and help people?
Well, I mean, so we're taking it, as I said, into the neonatal intensive care unit, trying to understand the role of sleep in preemies. I mean, NICUs are not wonderful environments for sleep. And I'll give you an example. In general, the care of babies in these NICUs has been guided by the doctor's schedules, when they are available, when they do things, or the nurse's schedules as well. And generally, they don't pay attention to the sleep in these neonates, which is extraordinary because sleep is the most important part of their lives at these ages. So that may seem hard to imagine, you know, but it's true. And not too long ago, NICUs were brightly lit, very noisy. And it's only in recent years that NICUs have started to pay attention to these factors and the disruptions to sleep that they were causing. I have a colleague in the Netherlands now who's taking the work that I and others have done and is saying, we can monitor the babies in these incubators in real time. And we can have a little monitor above each incubator for every baby that says, like, they could think about it like as a stoplight or like a traffic light with a green light and a red light. Green meaning, go ahead, the baby's awake, go ahead and do what you have to do to take care of the baby. Or a red light meaning, you know, this baby's asleep, let the baby sleep, and then, you know, just give it a little bit. That is a brand new phenomenon that has never been done before. It's the only NICU that I know of in the world that's doing it. And that's the sort of change for care for premature infants that's taking place. And I would love to see that tried out in a whole bunch of other NICUs, preferably every single one, because it's just such a blind spot that neonatology has had. Another really interesting place where people have taken this work is in robotics, because, you know, robots are generally programmed to do what they do. But the question becomes, can you make a more adaptable, more flexible robot by allowing them to learn about their bodies? So imagine a robot with limbs like us, rather, and instead of simply programming the robot to use its limbs in particular ways, allow it to twitch and learn about its limbs through a more natural process. What does that mean for how robots behave? And so the work that's been done on that so far has shown that robots that learn about their body, about their limbs through twitching, are more adaptable to changes in their body, such as, say, the amputation of a robot limb, than animals that were pre-programmed that way. And so that does two things. One, it tells us, it allows us to test ideas about what sleep and twitching does, you know, in us by simulating it in a robot. But it also has the potential to create robots that will be more adaptable and smarter in the future. And so that's another interesting. So two ends of the spectrum, you know, little babies and a NICU and a robot.
What happens when those robots start having dreams?
Oh, that's, yeah, I don't know. We wake them up and they just don't say very much. But it is, you know, it's a Blade Runner.
In the preemies, how could a regular sleep or being awakened, that preemie being awakened for some type of medical intervention, how could it affect that infant's development?
Well, the possibility is that it affects it in all kinds of ways. So there are two ways to deprive somebody of sleep. I mean, you can deprive them, meaning you just do not let them go to sleep, which is, you know, used as a form of torture. But also has been done for scientific purposes to understand the role of sleep. You can also have a more what's called sleep restriction, where you're just never getting quite enough sleep and you're constantly being, you know, awakened and disrupted. You're allowed to go back to sleep, but you're just never allowed to go through full cycles or have the amount of sleep that you normally would get. And they have different effects. I mean, obviously in magnitude, but both are detrimental. And so then the question becomes, you know, as good as we have become at taking care of these premature infants, you know, really, really early and allowing them to survive, they have a lot of, they are much more prone to a variety of different problems as they grow up. And so understanding better the role of sleep and maybe mitigating some of those negative effects of prematurity by taking better care of the sleep of these babies might have a real effect on the quality of their lives.
In our last moments together here, do you anticipate scientists will be able to understand the role of dreams, or will this aspect remain a mystery?
People are getting cleverer and cleverer about studying dreams. And, you know, there are these lucid dreams that people study and things like that. There are a variety of things that people are doing, but in the end, it all comes down to whether dreams, as you put it earlier, you know, do they have a function to themselves, or are they a byproduct of the process? You know, I think that dreams reflect how our particular brains work, but whether or not they are them should be a target of our investigation, that's an open question. They may just be byproducts of an underlying system. So they may reflect important processes, but may not of themselves be important. That's one of the other mysteries, I think, that will stick around for a while.
Mark, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
My pleasure. Good morning, Wisconsin.
Mark Blumberg is a professor and chair of the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences at University of Iowa. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.